The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
As I was saying, anyway, this is the village of Sde Trumot we just passed through, and it's built on the site of the ancient Sde Trumot. Sde Trumot was a city, it was the border of Israel in the time of King David. Now those mountains up above us that we're passing in a second, to our left, are the mountains of Gilboa. Okay? Now picture a map of Israel. Okay? On a map of Israel, right, we are on the eastern border of Israel. Okay? We're sort of heading up the Jordan Valley alongside the mountains of Jordan, which we're actually heading towards, right? And we're actually entering Emek Bet Shan, the Bet Shan Valley, which is a part of the Jordan Valley. And the Philistines, the Plishtim, who were a warlike, warrior-like tribe, okay, basically lived along the coastal region in the cities of Aza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gat. Those cities were ancient cities. They date back to the time when the Jews left Egypt and did not come directly to Israel because the warlike Philistine tribes. Nothing to do with the Palestinians, don't get confused. They were Philistines, not Palestinians. But anyway, eventually the Plishtim, who were a warlike tribe, attacked Jews, they stole their fields, and the Plishtim armies came north into the mountains of Gilboa. Then, like now, this was the belly of Israel. Because of this being the great Rift Valley and the best land, this is where the Jews farmed, and this is where they all lived. And therefore, imagine an army coming down out of those mountains with a tremendous strategic advantage. So King Saul realized that he had to meet them in the mountains. They had a much larger army. And he took his son Jonathan, and they gathered the men of Israel and they went to fight. And it was a terrible, terrible battle. And in the end, King Saul and his son Jonathan were killed. And they actually asked their swordsmen to kill them rather than be captured by the Philistines, which he did. When David, who now officially became king of Israel, heard that Jonathan, his best friend, his closest brother, and his father Shaul, okay, Saul, yeah, these are sunflower fields on your left. This is where sunflower seeds come from. This is a national pastime in Israel. In fact, you are graded on two things in this country.
Right.
How many times you honk your horn during the week, how many times you honk your horn, and how far you can spit your sunflower seeds at a soccer game. Anyway, King David heard that King Saul and Jonathan had been killed, and he rent his clothes, and he went into mourning, and he throws forth a beautiful poem, which I'm going to read you later. And one of the lines in the poem is, Sde Trumot, right? Don't laugh, ye daughters of Sde Trumot. Okay? In the town of Sde Trumot, let there be no joy. And that is this town, okay? Which was below these mountains where King Saul was killed. And that's this valley, what was going on here 3,000 years ago.
Wow.
Mamash po. Yesh kacha, yesh shama, itstadion, shela Romaim. וזה לא איפה שכל העתיקות של בית, זה ממש פה. ושם הרגו את רבי חנינא מטרדיון, ושם זה מקום מדהים. Okay. Because we are making good time, I'm going to show you something I didn't think I'd get to show you, which is an unbelievable thing to see. First of all, by the way, behind us is one of the only two Mahadran kosher McDonald's in the country.
Let's go.
And we are not going to go because
first flowering of our redemption.
Because I want to leave you things to come back to Israel for. But there's Jerusalem and then there's McDonald's. Alright. We are in the city of Beit Shan. And we are going to make a very brief stop. Bring a hat. It's deceptively, it's not hot, it's hot outside already. Bring a hat. You will definitely want to bring a camera. And you might want to bring a water bottle, but we're only going to be off the bus about 10-15 minutes. Okay? Come, guys. Come follow me over here, guys. Okay, watch your step going down. Hold each other's hands. Stop right here. Okay, real quick. because I want to keep us on schedule, but we really hit no traffic coming out of Yerushalayim. We made up all the time of our timely departure, and so I just wanted to show you this. Tour groups don't come here. Don't even try talking to another tour group and asking them if they came to this. They won't know what you're talking about. We are in the city of Beit Shan, okay? Beit Shan was the center of Roman activity in this area during the Second Temple period, during the period of the Mishnah, and leading all the way up until about the 5th century, okay? There is a huge, the largest in Israel, and actually the second largest in the Middle East, archaeological dig and center. They discovered the whole ancient city of Beit Shan, and it is really incredible. And we're not going to have time to see it, but you get a day. This should be on your list of, you know, what we could be doing, which is to visit, not this, because this you have to come with somebody who knows where they're going, but mamash to visit the ancient city of Beit Shan, and you see a whole city, complete with Roman streets. Have you been there?
Yes.
Complete with Roman streets. They actually found the Beis Medrash, the house of study of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, who edited the Mishnah. You can walk into his Beis Medrash. It's unbelievable. And that was down that way. Now there's a theater there. It's the largest amphitheater discovered, ancient amphitheater discovered in the entire Middle East. It's bigger than Caesarea. And that was a theater. This was something else. Take a look around you. Okay? There was a project to restore this, and then they ran out of money. I'm actually happy they ran out of money. I like to see these things in their ruins. You see those clear white benches? Those were added sort of like modern, like in the Carter we see the modern steps. Everywhere you see those white stones, they added them sort of because where they knew exactly what it must have looked like to create the effect. Okay? Everything else was as they found it. Now look at these openings. Do you see how some of these openings are shorter? Why are they shorter?
Animals.
Lions. Ever hear about Gladiator the Lions?
Yeah.
That was here. Okay? This was a stadium. This was an arena. This is where the Roman games were played. They brought Jewish slaves to this arena, and they had to fight the lions. And the most famous story that happened here is the story of Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan. Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan was murdered in the stadium of Beit Shan. He was not murdered in the theater, he was murdered here. They brought him here. They had a huge crowd. According to some opinions, it was done right before the games. And they brought him out and they wrapped him in a Torah scroll. This was after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, right? And Hadrian was determined to put an end to every last vestige of Jewish independence. We talked about this in the Old City. So Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan is one of the 10 martyrs in the prayer that you read about, called the Ela Eskara, that you read about on Yom Kippur. Okay? They wrapped him in a Torah scroll, and they set it on fire. And they put cotton wool, and they soaked it in water, and they put it on his vital organs, so that it would take him longer to die. So the executioner, the Roman executioner, who was doing this, right? So he asked Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, if I take the cotton wool off you, so that you can die quickly, will I go to heaven? And Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan said, absolutely, and I'll be waiting for you to bring you in. So this executioner takes the cotton wool off, jumps into the fire with Rabbi Chanina. And as they're dying, the students ask Rabbi Chanina, okay, who according to one opinion in the Talmud was actually smiling, they ask Rabbi Chanina, what do you see? What do you see? Why are you smiling? Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan says, I see the scrolls burning, but the letters are flying into the air. And the rabbis ask, what made a Roman executioner, who must have executed thousands of people, I mean, this was part of the game, you know, see a lion rip up a couple of slaves, see a Jew get killed, and let's get the popcorn. That's just what they did back then. So what made this executioner suddenly jump into the fire? They say that if you could see Rabbi Chanina ben Trajan, you could not help but be moved. He must have been such an awe-inspiring individual that this fellow suddenly realized what he was doing. Now, you think that that's a sad story, right? It's terrible. Why would I start to deal with such a sad story? It's not a sad story at all. Because what does it mean that he saw the scroll burning but the letters going into the air? Torah is not about scrolls. It's not just a physical book, you know, we respect the scroll, we stand up for Torah scroll, but that's just what it represents. The reality of Torah are the letters in the air. They're the messages, the idea, the spirit, the heritage. And the fact that we can come here, today, in the middle of a tour, as part of a Jewish learning program in the modern state of Israel. And we're still here. So that's not a sad story. That's an unbelievably magnificent ending. And that's like the last chapter in the book, but we haven't gotten to the last page. Because the last page is everybody's individual volume. How you choose to end the story, that's up to you. So I couldn't be right here and not take you in here. We don't have time to really sit here. Notice that the temperature has changed radically, right? We were up in Jerusalem, it was beautiful. We'll be up in the Golan, it'll be beautiful again. Here it's hot. You know? Ah, good question. Imagine, by the way, that you're a slave and you're being starved and the lions have not been given food for 2 days. And they bring them out, right? And they're ravenous. And you're like a Jewish Nebuchadnezzar, you know, you sit and learn Mishnah. Also notice where the spectators sit. It's just low enough that they can get a good look, and it's just high enough that if somebody wants to try to climb out, he can't quite make it.
Do we have any weapons or anything? A shield or anything?
Pardon? Yeah, no, you're actually given a spear. Yeah. Come, let's head back to the bus. This is the year 140 CE. This stadium was probably here since about 100.
What number are you?
This stadium, by the way, was built by Jewish slaves. You can see the remnants of some of the Roman pillars. Come, let's go. Powerful place, huh? You come here on a cool day, late afternoon. You just have mincha, you sit here on your own. Oof. Chazak. This is all part of stores and houses that develop around. This is actually later, that's Crusader period. Baruch Hashem for air conditioning. See that? You're sweating and you were there like, what, 8 minutes? Can you imagine having to build that stadium in the sun? Alright, so I just wanted, we're taking a detour in here for a minute so I can show you something. This is one of those stories, tragic and yet magnificent on both ends. This place is a place called Naran. And this was actually a place known as the Peace Island of Israel. Why? Because if you look on your right, you will see the Jordan River. The Jordan River flows here, but there are agricultural lands that belong to the kibbutzim. This was the best example of what I was talking about before. You can see the Jordan River. We're passing over on your left. You can see, this is the best example of the fact that we crossed over the Jordanian border, but they were leasing us this land, okay? Not only that, but because of the way the Jordan River runs, that it flows to the west here, Jordan is much further in. And basically, if you look straight ahead, you will see a Jordanian gun position. That is the Jordanian border. That's a Jordanian guard tower, okay? And we will be technically in Jordan. Right now we're still in Israel, but we're right next to Jordan. But because of the topography and because this is the border, so the Jordanians have guard towers that sit here right next to the Israeli ones. You can actually see the border. It runs right here up the hill. These are old gun positions, some of these. There was a school trip from the Beit Shemesh, from the school in Beit Shemesh, which is right below Gush Etzion, where we were on Tuesday. It was here on a teal. They were here on a trip. There was a fanatic Jordanian Muslim guard on duty in the guard tower, right up ahead of us. And basically this school bus of Jewish girls was doing exactly what we're doing. They're riding along here. And then they wanted to explain to them sort of how this canal was actually created by the British. It's a whole story here of the Independence War, how Israel took over the pumping station behind us. There's an ancient Roman bridge that sits along this river. We'll see one later, so I'm not going to spend the time right now. Anyway, as they're having this whole discussion and they get off the bus, they're walking on the hill right over there on our right, okay? And this Jordanian guard opened up. This Jordanian guard opened up, opened fire on them with a heavy caliber machine gun, and killed, if I'm not mistaken, 8 girls. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible tragedy. You can see the Israeli position on your left. You can see the Jordanian position on your right. Today, as a result of that story, the border is a much more significant border. Back then, it was just a fence. You can see the sign on your right, which is in yellow. Shetach Tzvai. This is a military zone. Hayirida l'tzir ha'tishtush asura. You are not allowed to take a right and go along this path, because this is a tzir tishtush. This is a one of those areas that I told you about that they sweep every day for, you know, footprints and tracks of terrorists. even if we stopped the bus here, okay, if we got off and walked on this path, which is what the sign says, we would be in violation of the law and we would be actually detained. We'll skip that. We're an international group, but we don't make an international listen. If you look on your right, okay, you can see very clearly the remnants of an ancient bridge that was built in the time of the Romans. This was a very important area, and this was how you got across to the Nabatean spice route. And that's a whole discussion in and of itself. You can see the old pumping station, which dates back actually to the time of the Turks. This pumped water to the entire Jordan Valley. There was a tremendous battle for this pumping station in 1948, and the Israelis succeeded in taking hold of this pumping station, and that's really how they saved all the farmland of the Jordan Valley from becoming part of Jordan or really whatever from the Jordanian Legion. Sorry, from Kawafik's troops. And, okay, we're not going to climb up that mitzvah because we'll be seeing another one. But I will show you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Jordan right over there. If you look on your left, coming up on our left in a minute, you will see the memorial that was planted to the girls who Tatsoshnia, to the girls who were killed here, and they made out of flowers each of their names, and you can see the memorial on your left, each one for one of these girls, and the pictures of the girls are on the poster over there. There is one bright cloud to this story, which is a powerful story, right? And that is that if you want to understand the difference between peace that could be and peace that just isn't happening, the best example I can think of is this story. You know, after this incident, King Hussein, who was the father of the current Abdullah, prince of Jordan, took a helicopter and traveled to Beit Shemesh and personally visited each of the families who were sitting Shiva. Okay? And that was a tremendous, tremendous message in Israel. I mean, it made all the news, you can imagine. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, over 70% of the citizens of Jordan call themselves Palestinians. They're no great fans of Israel. Okay? If a lawyer does business with Israel, he's expelled from the Jordanian bar. If a journalist writes a pro-Israel article in Jordan, he is thrown out of the journalistic union. All sorts of problems. Peace with Jordan is not simple. But the fact that you had a leader that at least cared enough to go visit and families that were killed to apologize.
Boker tov.
The fact that you had a leader that was willing to visit the families who were sitting Shiva, and you had this sense. I remember watching the peace agreement with Jordan. I came home that night. I don't remember where it was during the day, but that night I sat with the Reed and we watched it on the news, and the two of us were crying. Because you really had a sense that there were two leaders who genuinely wanted peace. It was the only one of all the peace agreements that you really felt that way. It was just unbelievable. And then you watch sort of the shenanigans with Arafat and Oslo. I'll give you one good example. When they got to sign the agreement on the White House lawn, it's in 1993, Arafat took a look at the final map. He didn't like something. He refused to sign it. Now you've got thousands of journalists from all over the world. Millions and millions of people watching live television newscasts. Whatever. And all of a sudden they see there's a scuffle on the side and people are running after Arafat trying to talk to them, and he's throwing his hands up in the air and he's walking off onto a hill. And Kissinger, who was in the audience, came out of the audience and somehow was involved in successfully brokering that Arafat should sign the map. And what they did was they had Arafat sign the peace agreement without signing the maps. He didn't sign the maps. Nobody noticed he didn't sign the maps. And when the story came out, people just never had a sense that they had a partner. They had a sense that they had a politician. And to this day, that has been the trouble that plagues the Arabs that call themselves Palestinians. You know, we don't really sense, in fact, this whole disengagement plan is basically about the fact that we just can't live with them anymore, so we're just willing to pull out, even though we're not doing it as part of an agreement, which is very, very challenging. But to see a place like this, and to realize, and I'll tell you one last thing, and that is, you know, there's something very beautiful about this idea, that we've taken the loss of loved ones, and we've turned it into a beautiful garden. That is such a Jewish message. You know? Anyway, we're going to head back up north. Look on your left, you will see very clearly that we are next to a banana plantation. This is a tropical area. Okay, now think about this. We came from the mountains, the lush green forests of Jerusalem, through the desert, and now we're in a tropical zone. Only in Israel. In Israel, everything is compacted. By the way, the definition of a tropical zone is how much rainfall falls every year. And this area actually technically just falls short of that. But there is a small area right below the Golan Heights that actually fits the world definition of a tropical area. This actually is a very significant banana plantation, but I'll spare you the reasons why. But in any event, look on your right, and you will see very clearly the mountains of Jordan, also known now as the mountains of Moab. We've left the mountains of Edom, which was south of here. We're in the mountains of Moab. Look at the mountains of Moab, and look how the mountain starts to go down. See that? And eventually the range disappears. And then a new range picks up. You see that? A little further away than it seems from here. We are actually going to be heading in that direction, and that should tell you that we're very close. The mountain range that picks up north of us after the Moab mountain range stops is the Golan Heights. That's your first glimpse of the Golan. And we will be at the Kinneret, where we will be turning right very soon. Okay? What's significant about where we're driving, by the way, is that we have now entered artillery range of the Golan Heights, which means that if you lived here before 1967, at this point, you would actually have the significant additional challenge, in addition to the dangers that exist everywhere driving on the roads, the additional dangers that exist driving with Israelis on the roads, because they all get trained in the military, now you're driving into a war zone. Now you will notice on your right a good example of a row of trees. See this? Okay, these are trees that are planted. They don't seem to have very much order. Different types of trees, okay? And you have a row of trees, then you have breaks in the row of trees, etc. These trees were all planted sort of to confound the Syrian gunners. Because if they could plant trees along the roads, then the Syrians would not be able to see vehicles coming along the roads. And that's why sometimes you'll see that there are tree stumps or little pits that exist near the trees, because that's where artillery shells took out some of the trees. It's like this ongoing game. We would plant them, they would mow them down. But it did save a lot of lives. Okay, this is a very important strategic crossroads. It's called Tzemach. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. We have now turned right, and we're headed due east, okay, towards the Golan Heights, towards Jordan, and towards Syria, which I'll get to in a minute. By the way, we're about to pass the center where the peace agreement with Jordan was negotiated, okay? And it was... Beit Gavriel. This is where Hussein came, this is where Rabin came, this is where they negotiated the peace agreement. It was actually signed in the Arava, down in the desert, on the actual border. Now I want you to picture something, okay? By the way, if somebody has access to a bottle of water, I could use another little water bottle if anybody has one. There's like a whole new bunch somewhere. This, by the way, is a beautiful, it's a beautiful hotel. It's like a sort of a village cottages type of hotel right in the Kinneret. It's called Magan. Very nice place to stay, regional places. This whole area is basically a... Oh, shkarech. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's basically a vacation site. Okay? And there's a water park called Tzemach Water Park, which is unbelievable. There are actually two. And if you're curious about these things, for whatever, let me know. I'd like to tell you about them. But, you know, Israelis come here to the Kinneret, you just got a glimpse of the Sea of Galilee. We're going to see it very clearly in a minute from up above. You can see again the banana plantations. This is a tropical area right here. Okay? Now, look ahead, and you will see up on your left, those are the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights sit above the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. Okay? And up until 1967, that was Syria. In fact, if you look carefully, some of the markings you can see on the top are the old Syrian gun positions, one of which we're about to visit. If you lived in a kibbutz down here, you were basically in the war zone. Okay? Between 1948 and 1967, an average, you ready for this? An average of 1,000 shells a day.
No.
1,000 shells a day, an average, fell in these valleys. In fact, the joke became, it was so common for the kids to have to sleep in the bomb shelters over here that they decorated the bomb shelters as their rooms. You know? And very, very difficult way of life. And very often people who lived here were asked by their relatives, why do you stay here? Why don't you come south, live in Tel Aviv? And their answer was always the same. The reason that it's violent here is because this is the border. If we move, then this will become Syria, and the shells will just move with us. It's not the land that they want. We'll get to talk about, you know, why Syria wants the Golan Heights, whether we should give it to them, all of them, part of them, whatever. It's an interesting discussion. But you just have to understand the perspective. Picture yourself living down here. Look up at those mountains. Imagine that it's 1965, and there are howitzers and artillery guns overshadowing your kibbutz. Could you do it? And you don't really think about these things. You know, we think of the hero as the guy who straps himself on his gun, jumps up on his tank. But around here, getting into a tractor was an act of heroism. You were willing to plant the fields here under the eyes of the enemy. Because, as a matter of principle, right, this is Mutzav Dorit. This is the Dorit position. This is where I always remember my wife. Because as a matter of principle, right, you know, if this land is ours, a Jew should have a right to live in peace and farm his land. Very, very difficult question. You know? They used to have to go out here with armored tractors. They put armor on the tractors, just like those convoys that we saw the other day in Gushet Zion. The boats that plied the waters of the Kinneret went out with armor on them. It was dangerous duty to do fishing in the Kinneret. Now look at this fence on our right. You'll see here, first of all, you'll see the yellow signs with red triangles. These are all minefields. Everything here is very heavily mined. This is a triple border fence. Now you look across at us, and you can see that close to us is Jordan. Okay, that's the edge of Jordan. But if you look ahead in the distance, that's actually where Syria begins. Alright, so you're looking at the point where three borders meet. There's actually a beautiful resort. What genius in his right mind would create a resort on this spot is an interesting question. But there are hot springs that are mentioned even as far back as the Talmud. It's an incredibly beautiful area. This valley here contains the Yarmouk River, which is a tributary that runs into the Jordan. Israelis have not vacationed and swam in this river for a long time, for obvious reasons. The roads that you're looking at on your right, cliff, those lands, any vehicles you see driving on the road, those are Syrian. In fact, you can see a Syrian gun position on the corner right there. Do you see it?
Yeah.
Okay, that's Syrian, not Jordanian. Now, take a look. We're driving along here. You see this wall? They built a wall in the middle of the fence on the right. Why they built a wall in the middle of the fence? Because it used to be that sometimes the Syrians on patrol, they would get trigger happy, and they would just take pot shots at Israeli vehicles. They would start shooting at Israeli jeeps, and soldiers were killed. So the first thing they did was they built these walls so that if you got fired at, you'd have a place to go, Tfos Machaseh, to grab cover. Eventually they stopped this occurrence. They stopped Syrians from shooting at Israeli soldiers. They found a very simple trick. Attack helicopters. It worked. They brought helicopters in. Every time Syrians opened up, they just took out a jeep. Eventually they stopped firing. These walls that are built into the fence, there's one coming up, on your right. Look ahead of us, you see it? A slab of cement. Now, I'll tell you an interesting story. In 1940, don't quote me on the exact date, I think it was 47. No, actually, I think I'm wrong. I think it might have been 39. But don't quote me on the exact date, it's very easy to look up. But in 1939, the British passed a law called the White Paper, which is... Well, that was definitely 39, but that's not what I'm talking about. In 1939, they passed a law called the White Paper, and in that law, they severely limited Jewish immigration. We talked about this at Yad Vashem, to 15,000 Jews a year, which really meant 7,500, because they just took all the Jews that they caught and put in places like Atlit, and they used them as the first 7,500. They were only letting, you know, out of Nazi Europe. By the way, that's a memorial to a soldier that was killed in one of those incidents that I mentioned, the one thing we just passed on the left. So the Haganah, which was one of the Jewish defense organizations that was fighting the British, Here you can see another Syrian guard terror up on the hill on the right. Organized a night, this is all Syria. Organized a night called the Night of the Bridges. And they blew up 14 critical bridges that led into what was then Palestine to demonstrate to the British, if you're not going to let Jews in, we're not going to let anybody in. And they blew up 14 bridges. It was an unbelievable masterpiece of an operation, considering the fact that all this was done by an underground movement. And simultaneously, within an hour, 14 bridges were blown. British troops ground to a standstill. And most of those bridges were repaired, but some of them were not. And one of them, which was not, which still stands as it was destroyed, which actually sat on top of an ancient Roman bridge, is a bridge that's in this valley below us. We'll see it for an instant on our right, sort of behind us, in a moment. And you can see one of the bridges that was blown up in the famous Leil HaKshirim, the Night of the 14 Bridges. And you can see ahead of you, all those fields are farmed by Syrians, the ones in the distance. Now down below you is a place called Hamat Gadir. Okay, look behind you, you'll see the bridge. It's in the valley, sort of behind us. Do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay?
Wow. Yeah.
That bridge back there over the Yarmouk is still not fixed. There's another one ahead of us. You see the other one?
Yeah.
The other one is ahead of us down in the valley on the right. You will have to stand up if you're on the left side of the bus to see it. The obvious reason why these bridges have not been rebuilt is that Israel has no interest in building bridges for Syrians to come across at this juncture. Now look down into the valley here and you'll see Hamat Gadir. It's a beautiful resort. Beautiful. It sits on top of hot springs and pools of water. And someone had the idea that it was an incredible place to build a resort. Israelis do go there. Tourists really don't. When tourists find out on the internet that it sits at the cross point of the borders of Jordan, Syria, Israel, it doesn't really motivate them. There is actually an Israeli tank position, a tank that is manned 24 hours, sits above that resort. I remember one year, for a week, my unit was tasked with this place, and I was all excited. I was coming to Hamat Gadir Resort to be in a tank. Did not see the resort. 24 hours, non-stop, sitting and looking at a thermal imagery computer to make sure the terrorists don't sneak through this valley. There were a lot of terrorist incidents that occurred because terrorists came into this valley, and Israel finally developed systems to stop it, and thank God, in the last 26 years, there has not been a terrorist incident here.
What did they do?
Well, whatever, there were different incidents that came in here, they hijacked buses. By the way, look down on your right, you see that little round tower? That's actually a British guard tower. The British had a very different policy. The British created their fixed positions lower down on the mountainside so you could be close to the valley and oversee the terrorists. The Israelis believe that it's cleverer to have them higher up and more defensible. Hamat Gadir. Oh, biblical?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is the tribe of God. No, this is Menashe. No, this is... Yeah, this is God. This is the edge of the tribal lands of God. Yeah, Mutl pointed out, I forgot to tell you, when we came up the Jordan Valley, these are fish ponds, by the way, down here. No, that's, the border runs, just so you know, okay, the border runs in the valley right below us. You can see that little strip of road? See that? That's the border. So this over here is Israel, and what's ahead of us right now is actually Syria. The fish ponds are Israel. This whole resort here. You see the natural hot springs?
Right.
Right? Okay? Yeah, it's a spa. It's a beautiful spa. It's a great place to come in the springtime, in the summer. It gets cool here at night. It's very refreshing. You do not want to come here in the winter. It's very cold up here in the winter. Although I have to say, coming to the hot springs is an amazing experience because you sit in the winter, the steam rises off the water, and then you get into this hot...
That's like what I say when...
No, it just means I don't have time. Which story?
The spice you started in...
What?
Something spice route that you said.
Oh, yeah, you know about the spice route? No.
I was wondering if you knew about it.
Oh, yeah, sure. There was a culture called the Nabataeans.
Yeah?
They lived about... During the time of Bai Qin, 2400 years ago, and even later. And they basically figured out a way to navigate the desert and to get the spices from, like, the Far East.
Okay? And, to, you know, the middle, Israel is a crossroads for the ancient world. Right? You have all the roads coming down from China. You have the roads coming down from Babylon. Right? It leads you across the sea to Europe. So this was like a major crossroads, especially in the Dark Ages and in the early Middle Ages. And this dates all the way back to the period of the Temple. So they built cities. Avdat. You ever hear of Ein Avdat? Oh, that's a place you would love. You gotta go there. You gotta go there.
Oh, you know what? I need
it's really best to go there in the winter, but there's a place called Sde Boker, which is where Ben Gurion is buried. Right below Sde Boker is a Mayan. Well, you can just write me about this. Is a Mayan spring called Ein Avdat. And that leads you to the city of Avdat. And there are a number of cities like that, of the Nabatim. And they were amazing places. I mean, you could see whole, because it's desert, you can see whole cities that are built into the desert. In fact, if you go to, I'm just thinking, we're near Mitzpeh Ramon, right below Mitzpeh Ramon, in the crater, in the middle of the crater, you can find a Nabati city. And they had this whole spice route. And they basically collected taxes from you.
Who were the Nabatim?
They had no Nabatim, the Nabatins. I mean,
idol worshippers were they?
Well, I'm sure they were pagans. They were actually, they eventually became Muslims. They were Arabs. And they, but they were very clever. They were the wealthiest people in the world. They had no army. And they had no government. They were brilliant. What they did was, they created agreements with the governments that they passed through. And they basically said, look, every convoy that we bring through your country, we're going to give you a percentage. So you're going to make free money. Now, for these governments to take over the spice route, that would have been a lot of work. And not only would it have been a lot of work, people wouldn't trust them. But everybody trusted the Nabatim because they had this whole network. So the governments made a lot of money, like if you were going through Morocco. So you're paying 20% to Morocco. So if anybody messes with you, the Moroccans are going to mess with them because they don't want to interrupt this free flow of cash. It's a brilliant system. So they just fed off of the system. What did they basically do? They created water spots. They found every Mayan, every water spot along the route. They took it over. They built the city there. They guarded the water spots. They were theirs. And you had to pay a tax to get in there. So if you wanted your stuff to go through safely, you went with the Nabati. And they had all sorts of other industries that came up out of this. Yeah, sure. So that's like a longer discussion than like, you know, a comment on the bus. And their whole discussion about Nabati architecture and the way that they built and the way they irrigated fields eventually. What's so funny? You're right, too funny. You know what they did? They built, this is the most amazing thing. They figured out a way to build buildings of sand. They mamash took sand and they built sand buildings in the desert that lasted for 2,000 years. Well, they can't figure out how they built them to last. So they figured that they must have built them with water. Somehow they must have hardened them with water. But there were no sources of water. So they started to look and they found that underneath every Nabati city are underwater channels. And they found these and they built the cities on top of them. They brought the water up. Brilliant. In fact, if you go in the desert and you're looking for water,
what's the single best Nabatean site you know?
Avdat. I think so.
What about Mitzpeh Ramon?
Well, Mitzpeh Ramon, the Machtesh of Mitzpeh Ramon is right below Mitzpeh Ramon. But I think Avdat is a nicer, better preserve. You can look up Nabateans on the internet.
Yeah.
Alright, somebody asked me before, so if I wanted to walk to Syria, how long would it take me to walk to Syria? About 3 minutes. Okay, that's how close you are here to Syrian territory. Alright? And you can see another one of the bridges that was blown up ahead of you. Now, I want you to picture something, okay? You can see, by the way, another British gun position that was on top of the hill there that basically has fallen into disuse. We don't really use it today. Because we don't need that particular strategic parity. And you can see from here again very clearly where the Syrian fields are and where the Israeli ones are. Look, by the way, at the difference in terms of the lush character. Now, by the way, if you look, you'll see that there's a mosque. See the minaret of the mosque coming out? That's Syria. It's exactly where the border is. Okay? No, not with the Syrians. The question of the Syrian border is an interesting question. It's one of the best places I can think of where deterrence works. You know, since 1973, Israel has kept significant forces on the Golan Heights, and we're going to talk about the story of the Yom Kippur War, and it has been a quiet border. Syria has done all its anti-Israel activity through proxy by supporting terrorist groups and controlling them very often in Lebanon. But no military aggression, not even shelling, has come over the border since 1973, when Israel finally made the statement that we're done. We made that statement, by the way, by shelling Damascus. Kind of this message like, next time we're not going to stop here. Now let me put you into a different frame of mind. The year is 1967. And for 19 years, the Jews beneath the Golan Heights have been bombarded by Syrian artillery. And then the Six-Day War breaks out. And a group of citizens come to Levi Eshkol, the Prime Minister, and they say to him, the time is now. It's enough. We need to put an end to this. Our children cannot live under shellfire. It's time to take the Golan Heights. Levi Eshkol accedes to them because of what they've suffered and because of the strategic value of having the Golan, and they decide they're going to take the Golan Heights. Now, there are Tachniot Megira, drawer plans. Nobody's really sure how it's going to pan out. And so in the Six-Day War, in 3 days, basically, they take the Golan. There are two columns of tanks after, you know, tremendous air bombardment that move up into the Golan Heights. There is a northern approach and a southern. This is the southern approach to the Golan Heights. We are on the southern tip of the Golan Heights, and this is where the tanks of Israel had to go. Now, I want you to understand what that meant. Look up on your left and imagine that you're a column of tanks. This is mountain warfare, which means that you're going tank after tank. This bus is traveling well over twice the speed that a tank can travel up a hill like this, especially back in 67. You're talking about 15 miles an hour top speed. Okay, mostly Sherman tanks. They've just introduced the new Patton tanks. And you're underneath Syrian gun positions. You will notice a lot of minefields. You'll look on your right, you'll see a Nikudat Milut, place to escape shellfire. One of the reasons why you find so many minefields here, the Syrians were nuts about minefields. And they mined every place. And one of the reasons you mine the side of the mountain is because if there are heavy minefields and some places are not mined, then you know where the enemy's going to come. And that's exactly what happened. Most of the sides of these hills are heavily mined or obstacled. Imagine trying to climb up this hill with infantry beneath a watchful Syrian eye. If you look on top of the hill, you will start to see in a moment some of the Syrian gun positions. They believed in a fixed earth position. You're a column of tanks, and you're coming up here, okay? And look now down below you to the right at those vehicles coming up the road. They're sitting ducks. You have to wonder what kind of faith, what kind of... You got to be psychotic to get into a tank, which is basically a moving ashtray, and put yourself under Syrian guns. Look on the mountain. You see those holes in the mountain? That is a Syrian bunker position. And the casualty rate here, they thought, was going to be horrendous. So what they had to do was they had to send infantry up over the hilltops to take out the Syrian gun positions before the tanks could move up the road. This was a very difficult battle. What is taking us 10 minutes to do took them 3 full days, inch by inch, meter by meter. Okay? We suffered casualties, wounded, tremendously costly battle to take the Golan Heights. But when the dust settled at the end of that week, on the seventh day, when Shabbat finally fell, Israel stood on top of the Golan Heights. And when you talk about the Golan, giving back the Golan, Syria, whatever, one of the reasons why a lot of Israelis have a serious issue with it is because they remember what it cost to take it. And they don't want to have to do it again. Now look below you on your left. You'll see all these, and you can't see them as well now, but you'll see all these like stakes into the ground. Do you see them here? Those are all obstacles, infantry obstacles. If you got this, this was a bunker, by the way, that hole on the left right now. That bunker hole held all their ammunition. This is impregnable from the air. The Air Force could not pinpoint this back then. And so they had to take this on foot. Look below you. Imagine what it was. I mean, they were like ducks in a shooting gallery. Look, by the way, how pretty. You can see the pool of Hamad Gader. And well into Syria. There was a unit of Golani that took not the first, but the second shulcha. You see where there's like an indentation that looks like an iron set on the mountain? And they were pinned down there for a day and a half. They had to sleep out there in the night because they couldn't get them off that mountain without exposing them to enemy fire. Can you imagine? I once was here with a bus driver who fought here in the Six-Day War.
What were the Syrian positions?
They're Syrian positions that down at the top of the mountains. And they had anti-tank units that moved in also when we started to attack. We are on the Golan Heights. We are heading towards the top. Look at the Yishuvim and the Kibbutzim down below to your left, and you will see how they were basically under the guns of Syria. Now, I'll tell you another interesting thing. You remember what we spoke about when we talked about the gates, and we said that the Jaffa Gate and whatever, by the way, here again is a minefield on your left. Every now and then a cow kind of wanders like somewhere near a border into a minefield, and everybody's eating steak that night. Anyway, it's actually, they opened up a restaurant near minefields on the border. It's called Mine All Mine. Anyway. Hey, I'm not giving up my day job. Anyway, we'll come around the bend in the middle. By the way, in a minute you're going to see white boxes that are on the side of the road. And those are actually beehives. They produce the best honey in Israel up here. And basically they create the hives. And then they come in with special gloves and they take out the honey. They thought they go on high. Something about the altitude. You remember we were going through the Jaffa Gate, so I pointed out to you that militarily, it's always good as a defensive position to create a bottleneck, right? You make the inside of the gate like an L, so they have to turn, right? So you do the same thing in places like this. Now, most of this area, as much as it looks like it's arid, is completely impassable to tanks. The rock here, this whole area is an ancient volcanic region, and the rock here is mostly basalt volcanic rock, some form from lava. It's the hardest rock known to man, and it breaks the tank treads. If you took a tank up on this hill to our right, it would crush the tank treads. Israel has now developed the Merkava tank, Siman Shalosh. Look at the Kinneret on your left that is impervious to these rocks, but back then we didn't have it. And because of that, there are only narrow areas that a tank can come up. So, Syria had tank obstacles that they built, because there were certain areas where the valley widened and more tanks could break through. And this is one of them. This is called Shine Dragon, Dragon's Teeth. This is an anti-tank obstacle. And the reason that Israel leaves it here to this day is because there's a special unit whose mission that it's charged with, they live up in this area, in the event, God forbid, that they see Syrian tanks coming up on the Golan, bulldozers rush here and throw those things across the road to slow them down. God forbid we should ever get to that again.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.